Radio.
Put these on. Welcome to Sing Songers. Here with Danny Tamberelli. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's it, yeah.
Danny?
Yep, Danny's great.
That's how you pronounce Danny?
Yeah. Yeah, it's always hard. The NNY at the end really screws people up.
So you did music. Did you do music on Pete and Pete?
Well, I got my first bass on the set of Pete and Pete. Mm. The art director, Dan Fisher, gave me his bass because I was griping about being in fifth grade.
Yeah.
And I wanted to play bass, and my public school, they didn't offer it. They were like, you can play guitar.
Right.
And actually, no, wait, bass has got four strings. Here's a violin.
Right.
So I tried to play the violin in fifth grade, and I was god-awful at it. And that's like such a punishing instrument.
Yeah.
To like, if you're not good at it at first, or maybe most people aren't, but I couldn't stick with it.
It's screechy.
Oh, it's so screechy.
Because you're just, it's literally you're rubbing.
Yeah. You're not putting the force in your right hand hard enough on the strings, and you get that terrible scratching sound. My grandfather was a great violin player. He played solo at Carnegie Hall when he was like 17 years old.
Yeah.
Guy from Italy.
Wow. Jesus.
Yeah. No, like seriously legit. So for like the first like month, I was like, oh, I'm going to be just like my grandfather. I'm going to be great at violin. And I was not at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But he gave me this bass because he heard me griping about it. And
it's also hard to learn to write songs on a violin.
I would imagine so, yeah. I mean,
anyone ever written a song with lyrics on violin? Because you gotta grab it with your chin and stuff. It's hard to sing.
Yeah, who's playing violin and Electric Light Orchestra?
Oh yeah,
maybe that guy had written a couple songs.
Yeah, I wonder if he did. I wonder if if Jeff Lynne wrote on violin.
Yeah, right. Did Jeff Lynne? He could have. I mean, now you see, it's just him. It's the Jeff Lynne experience doing all those songs.
Yeah. He re-recorded everything so he didn't have to pay Capitol or whoever.
Smart.
Yeah.
It's a smart man there.
But not the same, you know?
No, totally not. There's magic in those records.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Yellow records, man, for real.
Yeah, I just bought a bunch. I told you I went record shopping. I bought, Sweet Talking Woman. Starts out with a violin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so I started playing bass at 11. And
so when did you write your first song?
I think I probably wrote my first song when I was in seventh grade. Just bass. I mean,
wow,
and I
cool.
primarily, even as a 35-year-old adult who plays in bands and writes songs still, mostly 80% of the songs I write come out of bass.
Wow, cool.
Yeah. So I play chords on the bass in terms of writing stuff. When I actually apply it into like band stuff, I'll play the bass like a bass a little more, just like bassline oriented, but just like chords and stuff, they just come out of my brain better on the bass.
And do you think it affects lyrics differently than writing on a guitar?
You know what? Actually, the hardest thing for me, because I went to school for bass and studied upright and electric, and I'm very low end theory. Like I'm very, very bass heavy in general. I find that it's harder for me to come up with good melodic lines for, just melodies for lyrics in general.
Yeah.
Like it happens and it comes out, but that's always the last part for me.
Yeah.
Because I'm so ingrained in like the rhythm and even as someone who like grew up like listening to Phil Lesh and like the very like melodic, sort of meandering bass line stuff, like Grateful Dead-y stuff, there's just something. I always try to make something different, right? Out of the gate. This is when I'm playing bass and writing a song, all I can really get in my head is like the idea of the song, like how is this going to be, the chord changes, like
the rhythmic, the meter of the lyrics and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I write all the lyrics for my band and they come out, it's always the last thing. Like I have, even right now, I probably have like four or five songs that are fully completed, but need the melodic lyrical attention that takes me the longest.
Right. Yeah. And your band is Jounce?
Jounce. Yeah. We've been a band for 17 years now.
Wow.
Just since we were all, high school buddies. We played in the junior and senior battle.
And you wrote all the songs for that?
I wrote all the lyrics for all that stuff. Yeah, all the lyrics, yeah. Musically, it's about a 50-50 split with the guitar player, and he and I are the only two guys still kicking around. It's our original drummer, and we've had like four drummers. We have Spinal Tap drummers mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're with us for a short amount of time. They make a little impact, and then they explode.
Wow. Yeah.
We have a good one, right? We have a good one right now. Yeah. So
drummers usually explode. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a great comment on that movie, because they do explode in some way.
They do. They definitely do. Our last one exploded back home to where he grew up in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So that was a large explosion from New York to Kentucky.
Yeah.
You know,
there's my sidekick, Church. She just walked in.
Hey, Church.
Hey.
So what's, the thing I wanted to ask you about, Pete and Pete is, 'cause you worked with, one of my favorite songwriters,
who's that?
Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Iggy Pop was the coolest dude ever. Like, I can't say enough about how awesome he was.
Yeah.
Particularly to a kid who was 11 and 12. And really starting to enjoy music on my own.
Yeah.
And then having this like legend, like I didn't know who Iggy Pop was. I had no idea. My dad was like,
I didn't know who he was until I was like 25, 26.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah. Well, my dad,
I mean, I knew of him, but I really didn't know who he was. Yeah.
Well, my dad was a fan, and he caught wind that he was coming, and he was like, "We're going to the basement." And he brought me down to his basement. My dad is a, excuse me, he's worked for electronics his whole life. He worked at Sam Goody when he was 15 and lied about his age, and has been selling speakers, and worked for Altec Lansing and JBL, and he works for Yamaha currently now. So he's a big audiophile, and he has...
Is he a musician at all?
No. No, just an avid listener. I think he sang in a band in high school, but he wasn't a musician in any way.
Yeah.
But he has like 3,000 records and all of them that he's kept forever. Wow. So he brought me down in the basement, and he pulled out Funhouse, and he put it on for me, and I was like, holy shit, what the hell is this? This is amazing. And as you do when you're in seventh grade and you're a kid and you're just a sponge, I went through Raw Power, I went through the first record, like he had those first three are the ones that I remember just like playing over and over again for a week before he came on set.
Yeah.
And then when he came on set, I just like spewed out all this knowledge to him, and I was like, oh man, like, I love TVI, you guys are awesome, like, the Stooges are a great band, and he looked at me like I had five heads. He was like, who the hell is this little kid?
Yeah.
It was like 1993, like, who the hell is this kid, and why does he know who the Stooges are, and why is he so into it? But
is that when Pete and Pete started in 93?
Well, the original shorts started in 89.
Oh.
So they were like interstitials, they were basically Nickelodeon promos for Nickelodeon, like hidden as these little like 60-second vignettes.
Right, yeah.
But the real show was 93, 94, 95 as like full series for Nickelodeon.
Oh, wow.
I used to watch it. Oh, you did?
Yep.
Excellent. Great, Church.
You know, I met Iggy around 93 because I wrote a pilot for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, where he played a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Because I had just seen him perform on stage, and he was jumping around like a 12-year-old boy.
And he still does.
Yeah, no, he still
does. Amazing. It's amazing. That's still been his shtick the whole time.
He's exactly as old as George W. Bush, and he's jumping.
Yeah, that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we became really, like, close friends, like, on the set. Like, I would sit with him at lunch anytime he was on set. We would just talk about music, and he'd, you know... It was really cool as an 11-year-old kid that he was treating me like an adult. Like, he wasn't talking down to me like a child. We were just like literally talking about rock and roll and like the MC5. Because at that age, I knew who the MC5 was again from my dad.
Yeah.
I was asking him about like the difference of being in the Detroit area at that time, and like he was just, you know, we were just literally talking about music, and it was such a cool experience. And one day he was on the set and he walked by my dressing room and he saw me playing bass.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, cool. He's like, well, I'm going to bring my guitar in tomorrow. I'll be here tomorrow. Like, you know, is there anything you want to play?
Oh, my God.
And I was like,
what?
I swear to God. And I was like, yeah, let's play TBI.
Yeah.
And the next day he came in, and the other guy who's the other P, Michael Morona, he also played guitar. And I told him, and he brought his guitar. And so at lunch the next day, Iggy Pop is in my dressing room, and I brought my little bass amp, and Mike had brought his guitar, and he gave us a straight up tutorial to play TVI, and then we played it with him as he was singing it and playing around. He had this PRS that had glow in the dark inlays that what I remember, and him being like, yeah, I can't see so good on stage without it, so I got these cool glow in the dark inlays so I can help see what's going on while I'm rocking out or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's so rock and roll. Like he's modding his guitar because he's losing his eyesight because he's an old rocker. Like, love it.
Yeah, and that was back in
93.
We don't see him much playing with a guitar these days. He's just doing his shirtless strut.
Yeah.
When I met him, he was drinking wheatgrass at Life Cafe.
The Life Cafe.
Yeah, and I was trying to like pitch him the show, and he wasn't paying attention. And I'm like, now Iggy, pay attention. And he said, sorry, man, there's pussy everywhere.
Well, he brought his wife in one day, and his wife was Asian, and as a 11-year-old kid, my direct association with that was John Lennon. And I said to him when I met his wife afterwards, and we were like having lunch, I was like, cool, so you're doing the whole John Lennon thing, huh?
Jesus.
You're a kid. As 11 years old, you can get away with that.
He doesn't look like he gets offended.
And it wasn't said in any sort of bad way. It was just a funny thing that I also remember being like, oh, like, why did I say that?
So do you think your writing style was shaped a little bit by those Iggy years? Or
sure, know? I mean the whole crew in general. Like, I mean, even from the time I was like 7 or 8, like I was bumping like a my first Sony cassette player with like REM Green and Murmur and. They would make mixtapes and give them to me, and my parents would like clear them and be like, oh, yeah, no, it's cool. Like, the Replacements. Yeah, I like the Replacements. Squeeze, that's a good. Oh, Billy Bragg, I'm not sure you're ready for this. It's like, we're going to skip this one on the cassette tape for later. But I was like everybody's little brother.
Yeah.
So they were just kept feeding me all sorts of music, and it completely changed my life in terms of what I enjoy and in terms of music and what I wanted to do.
Who do you think of when you write? Like, are you thinking of a certain artist or a person listening?
No, I don't. When I write songs, I write what comes out of my fingers initially. You know, like I'll sometimes go to a guitar center or a local music store if I'm like stuck and I want to try to, you know, get my creative juices flowing and just play different guitars.
Yeah.
Or basses in general. I mean, just like most, when I do that, it's mostly guitar because I don't ever feel uncomfortable when I'm playing the bass. Like I feel very much in tune with that instrument. I could write on it all the time, but there are times when you just get a little stagnant. But for me, like if I'm playing even a guitar that has a different kind of scale and it's just, you know, it's just, you're not comfortable. And when I'm not comfortable playing, I feel like, I end up messing around a little bit more on the guitar to try to get more comfortable, and then like, you know, things will pop out. So it's a lot more spontaneous. And again, like I grew up I didn't learn music until I went to college.
Right.
So, but I've been playing in bands since I was in 7th grade. So I just always had an ear, you know, so I'd be like, oh, we're playing an E. And like when I was not giving a shit about music and didn't really know, it's like, okay, E, and like, you know, I could figure out what the right notes to make it major or minor was based on if I hit a clunker or not, and be like, oh, okay, this is what it is. Now, when I developed the ear like very early.
Yeah. And when you got your bass, was there a reason you were given a bass? Did you lean more toward rhythm?
Yeah, I wanted to play bass. Yeah. Like I was, at that time that I first wanted to get a bass, I was obsessed with Primus and thought Les Claypool was the coolest guy in the world. But I had also was really into The Who and thought John Entwistle was the coolest guy in the world. And they're such opposite ends of the spectrum bass players, but both so completely like fluid and you know, kings of their instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
They really had a good knowledge of how to be loud and flashy when necessary, and also just be like sort of rhythmic. And it's just always been that way. My mom was real big into Motown and listened to Motown while I was, you know, in her belly. So I feel like maybe that also was a part of it that I've just always sort of felt rhythm.
Yeah, I mean, like the times I hear bass, because I don't hear bass a lot.
A lot of people say that.
I'm in a band and I, you know, my bass player, I look at her, I'm like, what are you doing in this band? You know, but like, you know, you hear like Motown or Parliament.
Yeah, man. Jamerson, Bootsy Collins.
Like. I mean, that's all you hear is bass. And yeah. And
yeah. So that
now
really...
when you write, do you like having drums? Do you have a drum machine? Do you like writing with a drummer?
No, I do everything percussive on the bass.
Yeah.
So if I will just like slap on the strings just after the fact. So I have a little, you know, I have a Roland 880 EX, which is like a 1999, 2000, 2001, like, you know, outboard, like stupid Roland recording machine that it's completely obsolete and nobody should be using it, but I use it still.
Because
I really like it. And it was something I learned, and I'm like, you know, I can work with Pro Tools and I can do stuff on
the computer.
Is
this like a 4-track?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a digital 8-track is what it is.
Digital.
It's a digital 8-track with six analog quarter inch outs and also two digital.
Yeah. Because I started recording on like a tape, little cassette 4-track
kind of thing. It's exactly the same thing, except it came with an outboard like CD burner.
I lost probably
15 years ago in college somewhere, like sold it for weed or something stupid.
Could sell that thing to some hipster for a mint.
Oh boy, right? I was such an idiot. Yeah. But no, I keep it and I end up just, when I have it mixed to how I want it on the board, then I'll just plug in the digital out and then just, you know, press record on Pro Tools and it goes through like it's a one channel thing. So I basically mix whatever I want to like send out to the band and be like, oh, this is a new idea I have.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's mostly all on bass and guitar and just, you know,
so you
banging
play,
out.
You play guitar too?
I play guitar too, yeah. But
yeah,
I play for myself.
Yeah.
And I play to write songs.
To write, yeah.
Yeah, but I play out bass. Like I play in a few different bands and that's my main goal is just playing bass.
Do you ever start with lyrics? Just lyrics?
Rarely. It's always a musical thing, mm-hmm. and then like I kind of think about what
the
music
feels
like,
and
then I write lyrics. The few times that I have, and they've just been chorus related stuff, that where I can hear a chorus in my head, and I'll mm-hmm. you know repeat it and sing it a bunch of times, and then try to get it. Usually I use the bass and just sort of like play the vocal melody on the bass. Like I was saying before, like that usually is the last thing I do because the music comes before the lyrics and the melodies itself. But when it does happen, it's usually a chorus.
And do your songs get personal if you write that way? Can you?
Sometimes, sometimes they do.
You kind of subconsciously kind of bring those.
Yeah, I feel like if the lyrics come out first, it's usually something personal. It's usually something that like my brain is expressing that I need to get out or to, you know.
Yeah.
Just.
But do you ever surprise yourself? Like you write like all the music and then you come up with these lyrics and you're like, wow, this actually means something.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Many times. I feel like that's usually how it feels when I write normally, because when you write the music first, once you have, if you have the whole song done and you don't have a melody, it's like, it's almost more daunting because you're like, oh man, I wrote this really cool song, but like, I'm not going to play a 5-minute instrumental song. You know, I'm not Mogwai or something. Like, it's not going to be like that.
Yeah.
Shit, I better make sure these are good lyrics. Also, I'm so incredibly like, I critique lyrics so much because I am constantly listening to music all the time, and I want to make sure that I don't write stuff that feels cliche or that anyone would ever think is like,
right,
oh, you're forcing it. And then that's a stupid thing. That's like a, that's like my own insecurity, is that like I feel like I don't, because I don't necessarily write lyrics first, that I'm not a lyricist. And so I'm constantly trying to make sure that I am one in a way, that I'm not like,
yeah, I think
just like singing, well, you know, the guy has gone down the road and I got my, the band got stuck again and the tire blew in the van. Like, I can't do that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I it has to be,
yeah, right.
It has to be really personal to me, or it has to be something that
I think is a strong belief. You're a good writer, you're insecure.
Yeah.
At least I say that to myself because I'm insecure.
Well, I'll take it. I think you're never heard that before.
A good writer, you're critical of your own writing.
Yes.
Yeah. And you got to get drunk before you write.
Yeah. So sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I mean, drunk is a strong word because it depends.
Not too drunk. You know, just a just enough so you don't self-criticize.
Being completely inhibited is
right.
It's important. It's important. It's important to get it out. But then at the same time, when you're hypercritical of yourself, you know, if
it
you're
can
too
put
loose,
the brakes
yeah,
on
you
an
can
idea.
Be like, "What the hell was I thinking?"
Yeah,
you know. But whatever. What do you think Keith Richards was thinking when he wrote "Satisfaction" and forgot about it, and then replayed it on this, you know, cassette player that was wrapped around his neck?
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Tell me that story.
So Keith Richards, Keith Richards wrote "Satisfaction" in like some drunken stupor or high stupor, or whatever, and didn't know that he had recorded it. And like, I guess he'd do this a lot, so he'd have a tape recorder around his neck or something like that. And he, you know, woke up and was like, "Oh, what the hell was on this? Oh, check it." And then it was just that lick.
And he said, "This is ironic because this is actually very satisfying."
How satisfying?
Yeah, it's very satisfying for me because I've played it every show my entire tenure afterwards. But look how much money I have, and God, I'm still transfusing my blood every couple months.
How complete do you think it was? Did Mick add any lyrics or?
You know, I didn't get that far into the story. I know I should. Right? I just got to it. I was like,
haven't you met them?
Well, because it was
met everyone else.
No, I wish. I did get to see them though in 1995 for the Bridges to Babylon tour, and the Foo Fighters opened, and I was a little more concerned with the Foo Fighters than the Rolling Stones at that moment.
Yeah.
My poor dad was like, "I just spent $175 on you, and all you care about is that 30-minute Foo Fighters set from
it
that guy from
it.
Nirvana." Like, yeah, that's what I wanted to see, Dad.
I heard that tour was good, though. Wasn't there a literal bridge over the audience?
I think it went over half the, you know, maybe the 50-yard line, giant stadium or something like that.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Memories.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. You probably don't even remember what you were going to ask him.
Well, I was thinking about this, like, you know, notion of being critical, but when you're too self-critical, obviously it can put the brakes on an idea that needs to be explored, because so much of what writing is like kind of pushing through the things that aren't working, right? And then like finding the thing that works, and that takes time. And the fact that so many of us that are doing that alone, putting the brakes on our ideas when we're only judging ourselves,
yeah.
And then it just, you know, do you ever write with other people? Because I can see like the idea of feeling like there's criticism happening on the writing process, slowing it down or making you feel like you can't try things, like you were saying with the guitar, like, oh, the fact that I'm not as familiar with this instrument actually makes me come up with things because I'm uncomfortable that I wouldn't normally do if I was, like, saying, playing the bass.
Right.
So have you ever tried writing with other people? Like,
yeah.
Does like the idea of judgment on the writing process actually like help bring out or hurt?
I just think it's constructive, whether it's good or bad. Because sometimes I've written with people and been like, this isn't gonna work. But other times I've written with people and been like, wow, this is really great. And
yeah,
both have a mutual, if there's a mutual respect, even if it doesn't work out and it's not, you know, we're not simpatico, you know, you still learn something out of it. I may, you know, weeks later, like do something that is completely related to that moment in time where I was like, oh, I didn't really know if I liked that. And then some
takes that idea and run it.
Playing a live show or something, and like in a jam, like something happens, I'm like, that melody's from. Oh shit! So like, there's all, yeah, exactly. Oh, well, this is in the moment. I'm not ripping anybody off. It's just in the moment.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by how you work with other people,
right?
Because I, you know, when I first started writing, it was just me writing on my notepad with a melody in my head, and then I had a friend who was into the music, and he actually went to school for it, and he was a great musician. So it was easy to divide the job there. But when both people write music and lyrics, like how do you usually go about it with your bandmates? And
with the band, if I didn't write the song and the lyrics, and like Matt is our guitar player, mm-hmm. He would have a, because he doesn't write lyrics ever.
Yeah.
Like it's on me. So he'll bring me a full completed song, and then I'll be like, okay.
Wow.
I'm going to listen to this for a while and kind of hear a melody, or maybe there'll be parts, because he'll do similar thing. He does more, actually, he does way more than I do in terms of like giving him a scratch track or something that to listen to be like, here's the idea of the song. He'll go through GarageBand and he'll have like fake drums, and he'll have like, you know, he'll have played like keyboard bass on there to give like a little bass line. And
will he have a substitute for the melody, the voice, the vocal melody?
Sometimes he'll have like another guitar part and he's being like, this is like the idea I have for, you know, maybe a melody or like a chorus part, and then I'll have to go in and you know, try to sing along to that, and sometimes that morphs into me changing the melody a little bit and making it fit with lyrics in general, just the wording and the phrasing to come up with something. And maybe because he doesn't write any lyrics, he's never been like, oh man, no, that sucks, man. He's always like, all right, great, we have a full song now.
Right.
Like, have you ever taken one of his songs that he wrote and he's like, man, I really love this song, this is great, and then you add your lyrics and they're really personal and it becomes more your song in some way?
Right. That definitely happens, and he's never expressed concerns or reservations about it.
Yeah, that's got to be strange, too.
But we've also known each other since we were 11 years old, and like, we've been playing music together since eighth grade.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it's got to be strange to give birth musically to something, and then you giving birth lyrically and thematically to something.
Right.
And it's almost like, I don't know. It's almost like you guys are fucking.
It is.
Well, then I'm fucking a lot of people, because that's 90% of how I write is by other people sending me tracks, because I don't play
instruments.
Right,
and then you write very personal lyrics.
Yeah. And like you said, like, you know, many of these people I barely know at all who I work with, and they're always happy when it is incredibly personal. They love it when it takes on meaning that they couldn't give it themselves.
That's exactly the other side of what you're saying too. Yeah. Or just a different side. Is that, sometimes people are like very happy that the music that they created made you
inspired
express
you.
Yourself
exactly.
And inspired you in a way to get, you know, open.
Wow.
It's such a hard thing.
That's a cool idea. I would like to.
But
try
I think
that
kind of
sometime.
Going with what like you were saying about it being hard to write with people who do the same thing that you do specifically, I think the key to that is also the fact that it's not what they do. What they do and what they excel at is building this track, and what they can't do is complete it vocally and lyrically. If that same person was used to completing things vocally and lyrically, because there is only one other time I can think of that this maybe was a little bit difficult to process, was when it was a male songwriter who was working on a project, but they didn't want a male singer. They wanted a female singer, the client.
Yeah.
So he would kind of like reluctantly handed off this track to me to write a song.
Yeah.
And had a lot of opinions about it based on his own idea of how he would have done it.
Oh man, that was actually a question or scenario I was gonna bring up, like the idea of like a guy writing this music, anyone writing some music and saying, I really want this to be about like a mother leaving her kid when he was three, because that's what happened to me. And then you got to go fucking write that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. All right. I'll try.
You know, I appreciate the fact that someone would get, if they have a full song completed, to be like, this is the idea I had. And, you know.
Has that happened to you?
No, but I'm just saying, like, if it had happened, I feel like if I wasn't comfortable, I'm the person that would be like, you know what? You probably should find someone else for that, because I can't relate to that. Or if you want to sit here with me for an hour and tell me about your life and being left by your dad at three or whatever you want to, whatever you want, like, maybe we can flesh something out. Because so in college, I studied with this guy, Yusef Lateef, and he was a really...
A Muslim.
indeed.
No, I love Muslims. Yeah, I have nothing against them.
So Yusef was really big in the jazz scene. Maybe
of course they all are.
So he was on like Cannonball Adderley Records. He gave John Coltrane his spiritual enlightenment. That record saved. He had a lot to do with.
Yeah.
And he played like weird instruments like the oboe in jazz and like weird. Like he was just way out there. He wouldn't call jazz because he said that was a derogatory term.
Oh, yeah.
So he would call it audio physio psychic music.
Why is it a derogatory term?
Wow.
Because jazz, the term, he said the term jazz strips composers of their genius, while jazz was being played in bars and clubs and classical music was being played at Carnegie Hall and these like big open spaces where people keep their mouths shut and just enjoy the music. Jazz is being performed at these like cabarets and places where people could be dancing, people could be sitting and eating food and drinking and talking over. There was when he was growing up, that's how a lot of jazz musicians.
The term
felt.
Does sound like a throwaway term, like
just jazz. It's just jazz.
Just junk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was really important to me in teaching me about no boundaries and B, know all of your stuff. Like he would come in and be like, okay, we're gonna play. I want you to play E flat Locrian mode. And it's like the most ugly sounding. It's just not. It's just a terrible. It's like a terrible modal scale because it's all like half steps and like just doesn't sound right. It sounds really like awkward. But he was that kind of person that was like, you just have to know everything.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to express yourself fully on the instrument that you're, that you enjoy and that you want to play, which is why I really got into bass and I played upright and that was my way of like learning how to play bass because I had played electric bass forever until I went to college without knowing like music was like algebra. It was like A plus two, you know, equals three.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what that A was, but I knew that I could get to the equation. Like I could get to the answer because I had an ear and I could, you know, I could jam with people and play and I could hear when people made changes and I would know where to go, but I never understood why. So when I went to college, I was pretty much like, I'm going to immerse myself in music and learn.
Do you think that helped your songwriting?
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
God damn it. I didn't want to hear that.
I'm so bummed out right now.
But it's only because of your arsenal. It's like, I know.
We
know.
Don't rub it in.
I still use the same thing. I still play. I don't write like etudes and shit. Like I'm not like, you know, I studied like theory and harmony and counterpoint and learning, you know, Baroque classical rules and rudiments and stuff like that. I don't use any of it.
Good.
You know, Bach was Bach was the guy who took classical rudiments and was like, fuck you, I'm gonna do whatever I want. Like you're not allowed to go up more than a fourth. Fuck you, I'm going up a fifth. And 5-1, that's, you know, that's the amen chords, 5-1. That's 5-1. That's like the basis of everything.
I'm using so many context clues right now to follow you.
I know, me too.
The five
chords. Like, I wish I knew what that meant.
The five chords of the one chord is the most powerful. It is. It's the most powerful resolution, 5-1. It's just... It just is. It's like
in Vegas. It is too.
5-1 odds.
Two things I don't know about math
And gambling.
And gambling.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Man, I don't know much either. I'm pretty good on those football parlays though.
Sports is another thing I know nothing about.
Well,
But getting back.
I should just take a nap.
That I'm an expert on.
It's the only
I could
thing
talk
I'd
about
be.
Naps. I should have a nap podcast.
Man, we did a live podcast a couple of weeks ago for the Danny and Mike show, and John Glazer was the guest, and he did 15 minutes on the best nap that he had that day. And he was like, oh, such a good nap.
The best nap he had that day.
Yeah.
Like he had several
naps. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Getting back to the idea of like someone giving you the main idea, I used to, I'm just going to tell a story. Because my friend who I used to write with, we used to just give each other themes to write about, you know, just as exercises. Mm-hmm. And, I wrote, and I'm not saying he suffered from this, but he just said premature ejaculation.
Okay.
And, right. You laugh at that. So obviously I came up with just like a joke song about it. But I never, you know, the idea of like someone giving you something serious to write about, and having to come through with that's probably impossible.
Yeah, well, also some people might want to make a jokey thing. Like if that was a song that someone wanted to make, and I'm like, well, the first thing I think of is the title of that song would be "Coming In First."
Mine was "Don't Let Go, Joe." But "Coming In First" is good too.
You know,
I had to write.
He's always
a song.
Coming in first.
I had to write a song for a zombie TV show. And the first thing I thought was, oh, it should just be called "You're Dead to Me."
Oh, yeah.
And that was like the tagline of the whole thing. And I was really proud of that.
Yeah. Or "You're Undead to Me." Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to rewrite.
undead isn't really, it's like, you know, "You're Dead to Me" is like a everyday phrase.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's yeah, why yeah. I like, changed
that's
it.
Why. That's why I made it more literal. You made it more literal.
I'm not saying
"You're Undead to Me." They're like,
I'm
you
not
know
saying
mine's something else
too on the nose.
I'm not saying mine's better. I'm just saying I rewrote it. Thanks for coming. No, we're not done yet. There's a lull now and then.
That's it. I like natural pauses. No, we don't cut ours in our show either.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Because it's real.
It is real.
A natural pause, much like if you're playing music and you're playing in a band and you're the soloist for 8 measures.
Yeah.
Sometimes a natural pause in there is good.
Oh yeah, I don't
voicings,
solo
voicings and yeah. And just I'm a big fan of that just because it's real.
Yeah, I'm totally in the dark when it comes to the idea of a solo. You know, but now when I write, I do think about like giving the song a little air so we can have some solos from the lead guitarist. Dude. You know, because he's great.
You gotta let him shine.
Yeah,
16 bars is like a good.
Yeah,
eight to 16.
Yeah, Grateful Dead shit.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah.
You know,
a bridge, a nice bridge.
Yeah, yeah. The Grateful Dead is a band that really affected me in the way that I hear music and
I'm not
respect,
saying
like I know
I
not,
just wouldn't want to see him live.
No, I get it. No, I totally get that. I was actually just talking to my buddy who is out here with me. We were driving the car and I had XM on and I flipped to the Grateful Dead station and they were in like the middle of like a jam and they just come back into the end this like booming beautiful chorus and I just like looked at him. He's not a deadhead at all. He just doesn't care about the dead and I was like, if you don't understand or respect like what is happening right now, not take all like the jammy noodle.
Unfriend
away.
Me.
Yeah, no, seriously, because they're a part.
You're dead to me.
They're a part of the American songbook. Like yeah. their songs are beautiful and like they're about, you know, there's all sorts of great meanings in them, and they write great songs. Particularly their use of the bridge in many songs is. Like awesome. It could be a lot of them could be whole new songs.
Yeah,
and
I
just
love
really heighten.
I really love bridges. Let's talk about bridges a little bit.
Yeah,
because
let's do it.
I'm always excited when I come up with a good one. There's some great ones out there. You know, I was thinking about, like, because my last album, we were talking about bridges with my band and how important they are. And I realized I didn't have a lot of bridges in it. And it surprised me because I thought I wrote verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus, but I don't, you know. But
the bridge is maybe a pre-chorus or something leading up to.
Yeah, or yeah. Yeah, just a different lyrics to the chorus or whatever. You know, I change it up in some way. But there are some amazing bridges out there. And the one that always comes up, and I won't remember which Bee Gees song it is, but it's an early Bee Gees, pre-disco Bee Gees song.
Like from Red Odessa or something?
Oh, fuck. I wish I could remember. Even if it takes a lifetime... on the Nights on Broadway. It's the Nights on Broadway.
Oh.
Because it sounds like a completely different song, you know? I don't know the lyrics, but it's like, "Get up on the Nights on Broadway." And then it slows down to "Even if it takes a..." something like that.
Yeah, do you know that song? I do. Yeah, I definitely do. One that really comes out thinking about it right now is Everybody Wants to Rule the World. There's that. "Say that you'll never, 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 never leave it. One headline, why believe it?"
Right,
and then
it
goes back into "Everybody Wants to Rule the World." And then you do it twice in that song, and that's definitely the bridge. And it's just such a powerful, different sound of the track, but also it's completely in the same vein. Sometimes bridges work well being something that is a 90-degree veer off of the song.
I think.
And other times they're like, 45 degrees. So it's like almost, it's still pretty much the same, but the intent is different enough that it's a heightening thing.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of times, especially in like Elvis Costello songs, the bridge is, now you're telling us what the song is really about.
Right, totally.
Because you're kind of coy until the bridge, and then he's like,
case you don't understand what's going on here.
Yeah. And then when McCartney and Lennon write together, Lennon's always the cynical one.
Yes.
So, he'll take a positive song of McCartney's and start saying life is very short and there's no time.
No.
That's why we can work it out because
we're all dead.
Yeah. And I like that kind of collaboration. That's an interesting way to collaborate. Is I don't have a bridge for this. Let's think of it.
Yeah. Well, I guess going back to when I was studying with Yusef in college, is that we would have these moments where he would put us together with random people and be like, create something.
Yeah.
So I had once I was so angry at myself for not being able to play the violin, I decided I'd buy a mandolin. Because it had frets and it was the same, it's the same chords. It was doubled up and I could strum it.
Yeah.
And I can play the mandolin pretty good. I mean, that's
you can?
Yeah. I love it. And I actually have written songs on that. And my band did a version of Bruce Springsteen's Atlantic City, and we kind of mashed up the Bruce version and the band version. And the band version has this really sweet mandolin part.
Wow.
So we had like one of my buddies just come up and play bass, and I sang and played the mandolin on it. I was like, oh man, I just played a full song in front of people in the mandolin. I was like, all right, I guess these 25 years of having this stupid thing has paid off.
Yeah.
But I remember writing a song for this class on the mandolin, and my buddy Matt Lorenz, who actually is this great, amazing songwriter, has a one-man band thing called Suitcase Junket.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely check it out. Like, he's got an incredible voice, and he tours around in his own van, and he has like two old-school suitcases that he pulls out. He makes that like his bass drum, and he has other things. So he plays everything on his own. He plays guitar. He plays, all the rhythmic stuff with his legs and other stuff. And he's great. But when he was just Matt Lorenz, my buddy, who were in the same class, we wrote this song. And I remember, the professor just being like, oh, this is like some Peruvian groove thing. And I was like, hey, Peruvian groove? I don't know. What the hell is Peru? I don't even know any Peruvian music, man. Right, like, yeah. I just thought this is a cool thing to you know, work out on the mandolin. And this guy, Matt, who I guess knew how to play the mandolin. I didn't know that he did, but he was like, oh, no, try this. You know, move your fingers up here, like, do this. And it was just a really nice collaborative effort that happened. Wow. And particularly on, like, a, you know, again, it's like an instrument that I'm not, you know, comfortable with that stuff comes out.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you, I have a guitar here. If you, you don't have to. I never make anyone play, but would you like to play something?
I mean, I'll play something if you want. What do you, is it something to create, or is it something that you want me to play a song that I wrote?
Maybe play a song that's maybe one of your favorite songs, or maybe...
One of my favorite songs.
Yeah, one of your favorite songs.
Or my own personal ones.
Yours.
Or something you wrote on the mandolin. And
now we're handing out challenges.
That would totally mess me up.
I mean, you don't have to.
It's cool. I mean, I can play a song, man.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. I'll let the chords in it or anything, man. Hooked it up. That's great. You probably didn't tune it. Whoops. Do you need a pick? I got a pocket full of picks.
A pocket full of picks. I can hang without the pick.
All right.
That's the bass.
It's his pick
the bass
pocket.
Player in me.
Is it?
Pick pocket.
So I'll play one that's called "Truth Defines," and it's a song that I wrote lyrics to in another song and like a weird early incarnation of the band when we were very heavily like a trippy dippy jam band, and then once I returned to my, you know, sort of punk rock roots, it sort of just became became this.
Yeah.
So like I'm sitting down to my last meal. I had too many things to say. Now I wish for you to go away. Better with a big electric.
It sounds great.
Whoa. Tell me things that aren't true. You tell me time always sues. And now it's over. Those bricks are broken. And now it's over. Truth defines. I've been back for quite a while. I didn't mean to ruin your trial. You tell me things that aren't true. Tell me time away, Sues. And now it's over. Those bridges. talking. And now it's over. The truth defines.
Great. You can tell that you're a bass player because you're using those top strings.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually at the end of that that last chorus, I was just playing the bass line on it because I like to play the bass line on it. Oh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, that song was written when I was, the lyrics were written when I was like 23, and it was about a girl, and that whole, like, you know, lying to me and the truth defines, like, you know, mm-hmm. that's, and that was, it was weird because it was in this very, like, trippy, hippie, like, you know, that song had a lot of cool, jammy parts and all that, and I just, it was a completely rewritten song, but I liked the lyrics a lot because they, you know, again, they're personal and important to me, and I didn't want to just let it go into the ethos and never come back. So I just, you know, I wrote a song that the lyrics fit to. Because melodically, it's similar. It's almost exactly the same as the old song, but the actual
the music,
the guitar structure, and then everything else, the music is totally different.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting. I wrote a song, and I was playing it for the lead guitarist. And I was trying to play it slower, but I wrote it in 3/4, and then, but for playing it for him, I was playing it in 4/4. I didn't even know because I don't.
Right,
I'm an idiot.
Right.
So and it changed the song completely. And I thought, all right, well, you know, when we speed it up, it'll sound like my song again. And I didn't know that I changed the, you know, the rhythm of it all.
Right.
You know. So. Yeah, he couldn't go back, and like when I changed it to 3/4, he's like, I can't use the same music.
Yeah, once it gets, yeah, totally.
Was it different? Was your song in a different time signature like that, or?
I mean, that was like the original thing, and that was like a little like stringy, you know, really mobile bass line, and it was just kind of this like bouncy thing, and now it's just a little, just more straight ahead, down beats, and and more, and just rocked out.
Cool. Yeah. Which version do you like better?
I like the one that we do now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a time. That's just the thing. It's like, I don't seek out jam music anymore. But like when I was in high school, and I've seen, truth be told, I've seen Fish over 100 times in my life, and most of them have been, you know, before 2009, 2008, like when, you know, they had just come back. I'd already probably seen close to 100 shows.
Yeah.
And that meant a lot to me. Like it was something that I was experiencing in the moment when I was learning how to play. And even when I wasn't in college and taking lessons and learning, but like I was into that kind of music, and I was into improvisation. I was into knowing how you could communicate musically with people and in many different settings. And that's, you know, I play in a couple different bands. Like Jounce is my main thing, but I have a band called The Undone Sweaters with a couple of comedians. And we're like, we only play the first album of the Weezer Blue album. Mm-hmm. We play like a couple songs from Pinkerton and like some dad rock songs. We play like a punk rock version of Reeling in the Years that I really like. But we've written like six or seven songs, and like they're, I sort of become the producer when like they'll come with songs and not know how to put them all together completely. And so I've sort of become like, you know, we'll play the songs, we'll learn them. I'll be like, why don't you add that? Why don't you, you know, that part's cool. Like, and so I've started to like, you know, almost produce this band, but it, the only way I know how to do that is because of learning. It's nothing I learned in college.
Yeah.
It's just that I've been playing music for so long, and just, You know, my ear is what gets me. But I mean, you can sit in a room and you can learn all your scales. You can be the most proficient guitar. Like I performed with a lot of really great players and been around people who are, you know, so much better than me. They just smoke me on like 6 or 7 different instruments before I can even like talk to them. Yeah. But they can't communicate musically with other people because they're so into themselves or into the ego. Into like I'm the most proficient guitar player in the room. But you're not the best because you don't have a voice.
Right.
You didn't learn how to like communicate with people. And that's the bottom line, because I...
That's kind of the joy of music too.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Like I love writing songs. I love being in a band. I love creating music. But my favorite thing and my favorite way to create music is playing live with people and expressing that moment in time that'll never happen again. Like I'm as trippy hippie as that sounds.
Oh, that's
like,
amazing.
I really like core of music. It's just what I love. I love being able to express myself. I don't know if you were, did you stay on Friday after the podcast?
I stayed for the first song and then I had to split.
Right. Well, that was, we played some music after the podcast on Friday at the castle.
Yeah.
With my buddy Nick, who's in that band Terramellos, that's really great. And they asked us if we just want to do some music or whatever. And so I asked Nick, and I asked Nick if he knew a drummer. And we never played before at all. And we just like had this really great, like, sort of stoner rock psych 25 minutes of just pure improvisation that was, you know, I was riding high until Sunday. It was like 48 hours of just being like, we never played together. People afterwards were like, oh man, you guys are so tight, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, there's, you know, whatever. It's not like self-gratifying, but it is. And
well,
nice. I mean, it's nice to know that like you can feel good about that and you can, the people who are listening can sense it. Yeah.
And
you
don't feel,
yeah, exactly.
That's the great thing about music. I mean, you know, I'm also a writer, and writers love to hate writing, but musicians love music. You know, I mean, it's just, it's universal. It's a beautiful thing. And you encapsulated it in what you were saying perfectly. You know, it's just, it's about working with people and communicating, you know, and it's a different, you know, they say that that's how we're going to communicate if a fucking flying saucer lands here.
Yeah, you know? Just play some,
music.
Just play some really nice major chords, make them feel like we're very good people and happy.
Yeah.
Just leave those.
Leave the minor
chords. Leave the minor chords out of it, for Christ's sake.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. Yeah, that are just, you know, just playing fourths. So.
Yeah. Well, Danny Tamborelli, do you have anything to plug before
I got a couple things. The band Jounce, jounce.org.
Jounce.
You can find us on Twitter at Jounce. The Undone Sweaters, same thing. I have a record coming out in February called Middle Blue with this group called Middle Blue with Mike Clark on the drums, who is the drummer from the Headhunters. And played on the Flood, and he played with Herbie. It was like the Herbie Records,
right?
Which is pretty cool.
Cool, yeah.
So look forward to
that's great.
That hitting people's ears.
Well, this was inspiring. This is this is why I do this podcast.
It's a great idea for a podcast. When we came out here, I made it a point to ask if we could set this up. So
thank you. Yeah. All right, man. Thanks for coming, and come on again.
All right, Church.
Yeah.
Dino, see
you. When your album comes out, you could
come back.
We'll have an audience then. I don't know.
We'll get it out there, man. We'll get it out there.
Thanks, Danny.
No problem. Feral Audio.